From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. According to the EPA website, quote, harmful algal blooms are a major environmental problem in all 50 states. Red tides, blue-green algae, and cyanobacteria are examples of harmful algal blooms that can give severe impacts on human health, aquatic ecosystems, and the economy, end quote. Well, you don't have to tell people in Southwest Florida twice. We're dealing with three different algae blooms right now. In this hour, we're talking about a few possible and some experimental solutions. Later in the show, we'll talk about an ozonator that can take red tide and its toxins out of the salt water. And we'll talk about mangroves that may eat up some of the nutrients in water runoff before it hits our rivers and Gulf to fuel those algae blooms. But first, we're talking about blue-green algae. That's the one in rivers and canals which lack the salinity of the Gulf. Much of it arrived via releases from the algae-covered Lake Okeechobee, a move the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made to regulate the water level there. This blue-green algae is the stuff that has canals looking like Technicolor guacamole, and it's the cyanobacteria that can cause rashes on contact and serious illness if ingested by humans, not to mention the potential fatal effects on marine life, wild animals, pets, and livestock. There is much conjecture on what we should do to make sure this algae isn't inflicted on coastal communities. But now that it's already here, how do we get rid of it? Scientists across the country have been working on solutions, and one is being tested right now. This month, a team deployed a new material to test its efficacy in removing blue-green algae from local canals and inlets. WGCU's Rachel Iacovone was on the boat with them and has this report.
The boat is packed with representatives from seemingly every water quality nonprofit or advocacy group in the area, along with a large pile of bright green foam.
The product is a foam, open cell foam, and it can have many configurations. The foam that has the long fingers, when we deploy it, it looks like a curtain underwater.
That's Glenn Watley of Aquaflex Holdings. The company started 8 years ago when founder Scott Smith created this technology to clean up the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. This time, it's not petroleum, but cyanobacteria that Aquaflex is after.
This foam will collect the phosphates, which are the nutrients. So it's kind of a two-step strategy, remove the bacteria, but also remove the nutrients, so you essentially starve the bacteria as well.
The vessel reaches a particularly green canal just off the Caloosahatchee River in Fort Myers, and the captain shuts off the engine. Smith, the inventor of these foam contraptions, climbs onto the stern of the boat.
What we're going to do here is we're going to put in the water an open cell foam that is designed for the whole water column.
Okay.
Ready?
Who's that camera, man?
Two, three.
Bombs away!
We're removing, detecting, and sampling at the same time. And what we're able to do is take the top, the middle, the bottom.
From the surface, the foam looks like a pile of inedible noodles. But below, Smith ensures it's already hard at work. The day before, the same structure deployed upriver had sucked up more than 16 times its weight in an hour. It's a promising way to battle the festering algae, and a cost-effective one, since the sponge-like foam can be wrung out and used again. But Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program's executive director says the efforts would be unnecessary if the bloom was stopped before it even had the chance to start.
Of course, the real solution for us is really keeping nutrient pollution out of the waterways to begin with, which is the most cost-effective way of addressing this problem long-term.
Jennifer Hecker estimates that treatment costs at least 10 times as much as prevention would. The Colusa Waterkeeper says it's probably closer to 1,000. Hecker, a lot of time out on the water, and this isn't her first bloom. But this trip, she has to wear a respirator.
2 weeks ago, I went out and did water quality sampling for an hour, and I was almost hospitalized for 2 days. It's not just people who have respiratory illnesses who are being exposed to these toxins that are having problems. People who don't have any history of respiratory illness are experiencing health impacts.
Once all of the Aquaflex tech is deployed, Florida Gulf Coast University will begin its monitoring and testing to figure out the full scope of the bloom in Southwest Florida waters and its health effects on those with or without pre-existing conditions. Rachel Iacovone, WGCU News, the Caloosahatchee River.
And as Rachel just reported, that was a test run, and we do have results in. They just came in right before this show. And here to tell us more about the development of the technology and those results is the developer, Scott Smith. He's the founder and CEO of Aquaflex. Scott, thanks for talking with us today.
No, thanks for having me on.
Also joining us for the conversation is Jennifer Hecker, Executive Director of Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to see you don't have to have your mask on.
Yes.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Jennifer, you just released the results of this first round of tests. What can you tell us?
Well, I'll definitely let Scott answer the majority of that question, but I think that, you know, what's important to understand is that this was just a demo where we do some initial tests to see if the technology would work in our conditions in Florida here. We did get some positive results, and Scott, perhaps you can share some more about that.
Yes, what we did is we initially went to the what I understand to be the only EPA and Florida EPA approved lab, independent lab, Greenwater Laboratories in Palatka, Florida, and we determined of various configurations absorbed into the foam matrix 45,000 to 250,000 parts per billion of the toxins given off by the algae, otherwise referred to as microcystins.
So these noodles, did they just pick up the toxins or did they pick up some of the nutrients? Or was this testing able to show that?
Good question. This first testing was for the toxins, and we have to send it to a different lab for the phosphorus. But we have prior work in Bermuda and the island of Nantucket where we have proven on a developmental basis the ability to remove excess nutrients like phosphorus.
So were you surprised to get these results?
Yeah, and to put this in context, because it can be very challenging to explain the science behind this, is the EPA has a health advisory for, you know, recreational purposes of the, you know, cyanotoxins in the water of 4 parts per billion. And, you know, their lead action level is 15 parts per billion. So hopefully that's the, you know, the concentration in the water itself. So the point is that's a really low level, and these toxins can be very harmful to obviously animals and people. So the point is, I was surprised and optimistic, and these are initial results, at the ability for this open cell foam technology and these special formulations to concentrate, you know, 45,000 parts per billion to 259,000 within the foam itself. And I want to be very clear, you can't compare the parts per billion concentrated in the foam to any, you know, samples from the water itself.
Yeah, it'll be different from water testing. It's like testing, yep, you know, a filter or a sieve on your, you know, when you look at your air filter in your, maybe in your air conditioning unit versus an actual air sample.
That's a great point, and that's exactly that's the best way to clarify it.
Is there any way to figure out the concentrations as far as the water column, if it's more concentrated at the top or the bottom? Is that something that these noodles are able to figure out?
Again, that's a really great question, and what I'm excited about here is the professional team that led by Jennifer Hecker and put in place, and Dr. Parsons from Florida Gulf Coast University, and that's one of, as we follow up on hopefully launching a more extensive, you know, pilot program to get some more research. That's, I look forward to getting the guidance and direction from Dr. Parsons and how to properly evaluate the whole water column. We don't know at this point, but I think it would be very helpful to get the data from the top, middle, and bottom of the water column. Because like I always said, aquatic life, lives in the water column, not on the surface.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the addition of scientific oversight to this. And I'm wondering, you said that you had done these kinds of things in, you know, for example, Nantucket and Bermuda. Did you have that kind of scientific backup, or is this kind of the first time that you're going to be able to walk hand-in-hand with a team like this?
No, we have provided to this whole team the prior research from Bermuda and the third-party studies done by scientists and independent labs. So, we always like to document everything we're doing with, you know, the proper science and independent third-party laboratories.
So, Jennifer, this is kind of some good news, and we were talking a little bit before we went on the show about the group of people that you have brought in to validate some of these things, because when there are environmental situations like this or crises like this, it's easy for a lot of people to grab at string, anything that they can think, and just run with it. Why was it so important to have backup from scientists and Sea and Shoreline, which knows the area there?
So the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program has always acted as a convener to try to approach these types of problems collaboratively. We have local governments, state and federal entities, nonprofits, for-profits, all different types of entities involved in our program. And each of those different entities has resources and expertise to bear. So when we are approached with a crisis or an opportunity like this, we look at, well, what would be the necessary team, the expertise and resources needed to address this issue? And with this cyanobacteria rapid response proposal, we wanted to make sure that we had that independent scientific credible entity that could oversee that the technical expertise that Sea and Shoreline brings with doing seagrass restoration in the river and knowing the aquatic resources. Of course, our own entity, which is very experienced with water quality and work on the Coosa-Hatchee, and then, of course, the technological manufacturer of the product. So having all of us come together, I think, brings the right group of resources and expertise needed to be successful. Now, we've done the demonstration, had some initial positive results. That allows us to know whether it's worth investing, and we do believe now it is, to move forward with a pilot study to further investigate, to gather that pre- and post-deployment water quality sampling that you were discussing. That's so important to understand truly how effective this would be in addressing our current water crisis.
Yeah, and Scott Smith with Aquaflex, you developed this absorbent foam originally for medical and then repurposed it after your manufacturing facility got hit by a flood. Can you take me back to that aha moment?
Oh, yeah. Basically, my entire manufacturing facility was wiped out in oil-contaminated floodwaters in 2006. And we had been developing an open cell foam for the, believe it or not, for the medical markets, for drug delivery, special medical lotions. And in the corner, this foam was, you know, sucking up oil and repelling water. So in the middle of this disaster that devastated the community, the company, the jobs, had a discovery. So as I decided to move forward, I became obsessed in with developing technology to get oil out of water. Now, I never thought it would lead into other directions and possibilities related to, you know, algae and cyanobacteria, but here we are evaluating it, things in the real world laboratory.
And then even getting out phosphorus too. Has it had any luck with nitrogen?
Yeah, we have not tested for nitrogen, and nitrates are particularly challenging, and we're actually working with some coatings that can be impregnated into the foam that may possibly work with nitrates. But we do have enough data to show that excessive nutrients and what is referred to as particle reactive phosphorus is absorbed and concentrated into the foam and appears to, you know, that it can help mitigate future blooms. At the end of the day, what I echo what Jennifer says, whether it's my technology or anybody else's, hopefully that will never be needed and you won't have to remediate the algae blooms, because the long-term focus is working together with a team of people to try to do what we can to mitigate and hopefully get the excess nutrients out and prevent these toxic blooms.
So this foam, is it reusable? Can you use it over and over again, or do you need to get rid of it?
Yes, and BP has issued press release and endorsements back from the USA Today business section cover in 2010. BP reused it 50 times plus in the Gulf, wrung out the oil and reused it. And that's a great question, because waste-to-energy facilities, it does yield 14,400 BTUs per pound. What that means is, you know, even without the contamination in it, and a lot of these waste-to-energy facilities have, beyond my expertise, but something like plasma incineration. So instead of moving the contamination and putting it in a landfill or in an underground water table, we're working on a solution, if it's used, to, you know, actually go to generate power and dispose of the toxins through these incineration techniques.
So, Jennifer, tell me, I saw you nodding over there. What happens to this stuff? Once you wring this thing out, you just don't wring it out, you know, over a sink. That would probably not work.
Well, I think that's a big part of the consideration of different technologies, is looking at the waste. I mean, one of the things that appealed to us at the onset about this technology is the idea that it actually physically removes the nutrients and the toxins from the environment. It doesn't kill them and allow them to be re-released and recycled and then uptake in new algae formations. By physically removing it, we're hopefully lowering the concentrations of nutrients in our waterways. And that's something, again, that we want to test in this pilot study. But I think that then once you do consolidate those byproducts, those wastes, that's another issue that we have to deal with is, you know, how to properly dispose of them. I do think that this technology, looking at several others, seems to produce less waste overall, which is obviously very beneficial, less to dispose of. But it is a challenge to figure out how to properly dispose of these and not inflict any harm in the disposal process. And we're working right now with the different entities to try to determine the proper way to approach that.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking to Jennifer Hecker from the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program and also with Scott Smith. He's the founder and CEO of a company called Aquaflex that's developed a technology that seems to be helping remove blue-green algae and the nutrients that feed it from the water. They've tested it and they have their results and they look promising. So we're now looking at a pilot project. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Jennifer, what is the state of the water in Charlotte Harbor right now?
Well, inside Charlotte Harbor, I mean, we do have red tide affecting a huge swath of Southwest Florida. And even in the harbor, we're seeing dead fish on the shoreline. So certainly we're being affected. I think, you know, our big focus right now, of course, is remediation, dealing with the current crisis. But moving forward, we need to continue to be persistent in the long-term strategies to store and treat water, to control pollution at its source. And there's a lot of work that we're doing right now focused on getting additional funding for those projects as well, because while we do have the legacy pollutants that are already in our waterways that do need remediation, we also want to make sure that we're not introducing more and new pollutants into our waterways, and we need additional funding for water infrastructure projects to do that.
Right now, you're looking for additional funding to do a pilot project. Am I right? Now that you have these results in, we're going forward with the possibility of doing a pilot.
So the $65,000 proposal that we are now circulating would be to do an acre of this Aquaflex material in a semi-enclosed setting, a dead-end canal or a marina setting.
I'm sure there are many people who will volunteer.
Yes, yes. Well, I imagine so. We hope to, of course, then wrap in the pre and post water quality testing so that we can really understand how we can deploy this technology. I think there's a lot of potential applications. If this proves out that this pilot study works, there are other things, reservoirs, other types of impoundments that we could be deploying this type of technology and perhaps improving the water quality in these water projects that we're planning and executing right now.
And you've put out a complete proposal overview along with your news release with these initial results. And it's interesting. You have everything, you know, sectioned off, travel, labor. I mean, you've got the figures out there. Who are you hoping comes up with this $65,000?
Well, we are approaching different local and state agencies to see whether or not there are opportunities to tap in to some of the algae response funds that have been made available. We are also in communication with EPA. They've seen the results and are interested in it. So we're hopeful that as a result of raising awareness about this technology, that there might be an interest in funding this small pilot study so that we can pursue this. Again, you know, it may not solve the current algae bloom, but the idea is to come up with strategies so that we're better prepared in the future.
Well, almost like up north, you have to have, you know, your salt stores ready for every winter when you have the snowstorm. Here we have an algae storm, it seems like now. Every couple of years, you might as well have not a salt store, but a backup of these open cell foam. So, Scott, I want to veer a little off course here. I want to talk about bigger picture issues with crises like this. I read your statement with great interest. It was released earlier July, mid-July, about the Flint, Michigan water crisis. And apparently, that was some uncharted territory for you. We have a link on that statement on our website for people who are interested in learning more. But the reason that I'm bringing that statement up is I can't help but draw some comparisons between that crisis and the algae situation here. Of course, obviously, that was, you know, plumbing, things like this. This is more somewhat natural. But in Flint, there was a lot of confusion and mistrust on the part of the citizens, questions that had been left unanswered, and distrust in the, quote, officials, those being like government entities, kind of led people to make assumptions, and they kind of grasped at purported answers and then amplified those, turned them into canon. But it turns out sometimes they weren't as solid of a piece of information as once thought. And that leads me to two things. Here in Southwest Florida, there seems to be a thirst for concrete scientific answers. And the lack of those answers has people kind of looking critically at some government agencies. Do you see any parallels here between people with an emotional or fear-driven quest for answers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated point. Every situation is different, and the dynamics are always different. But, you know, learning from some of these experiences, I think, again, with Jennifer's leadership and the team we have, this is set up properly to communicate in a professional, collaborative way with the science behind everything and independent testing. So, you know, these disasters and contamination events, you know, people want solutions. They want them quickly. They get very upset when they don't have answers. And it's just absolutely critical to have the proper regulatory authorities, the proper subject matter, academic PhD scientists, and, you know, and the local, you know, team of people involved. And that's what we have here.
And Jennifer, I'm going to turn it to you. There's sometimes it's difficult when you have science trying to do its work to prove what is or is not the cause of things or where fault may lie. And if sometimes the fault can lie with a government institution, which is then also funding some of the science resources, does that ever get dicey or is it difficult to keep pushing when the people that are going to be giving a lot of the funding to scientists may be the ones that are culpable in some ways?
Well, I think that's why it is so important to bring in third-party independent testing entities and scientists so that you have that credibility and that separation where they are free to follow the science wherever it goes. And I think part of the scientific process is understanding that you have a hypothesis, but then you have to test that hypothesis. And you may find things. You might have surprises. That's part of our learning process. And it's a part of adaptive management, understanding that as we go, we will learn how to refine and improve how we go about doing things. And that's part of learning how to be a better scientist and how to apply the science. And so it shouldn't be feared. That's why we want to do the testing, the further investigations and the field testing, so that we can hopefully understand what the applicability of this technology is and whether it can be scaled up to be meaningful in remediating this problem. And again, I don't want to overlook the fact that we still also need to be plugging ahead with all of the long-term strategies for more water storage and treatment and pollution source control, which will then complement this remediation and allow us to overall reduce the nutrients entering and already in our waterways to hopefully reduce the fuel for future algae growth. So that's really our strategy. It's a multi-pronged strategy, but science, it's all driven by science and the scientific process.
And the thing about science and the scientific process that I always go back to, as I talked to one scientist a long time ago, and he said, science is never static. It is never People are being taught science as if this is real, this is true, this is not true. And it's always something that's an evolution. It's always – they're always learning more things. And one only needs to look at the history of the incredible edible egg, which used to be bad for us. Then it was good for us. Then it was bad for us. Now it's good for – I mean, that's nutritional science, obviously. But it always changes and evolves as we continue to discover more things. So I find it very interesting, that approach to science and the evolution of what you're discovering is actually happening in the waterways.
Yes, there's a lot of complexity, and I think sometimes we in the desire to be simple and understandable kind of cannot go into all of the nuances and all the complexities. But the bottom line is there are a number of different factors that influence algae growth. Some of those are natural. Some of those are outside of our control. But we know that nutrient pollution does come from man-made sources and is one of those factors that we can control. So our work as scientists is to separate those things and to explain those things as properly and accurately as we can to the public so that the public understands that, you know, there are a multitude of different things at play here, but, you know, in the end of the day, let's do what we can to focus on the things that are within our control that we can affect.
Well, that kind of goes to a tweet that we had from a person named Gary. He says, well, he'll be chasing his tail, I'm afraid. Unlike the BP oil spill, this has no shutoff valve and will keep recreating itself over and over and over. There's not just the one mop up here. It's going to how scalable is something like this, Scott? Is something like this going to be able to be scaled to where it can handle these annual blooms that we're having with the blue-green algae?
Yeah, that's a fair and valuable point, and that's the purpose of a cost-effective pilot study to see if this can, you know, how rapidly this, how scalable this is, and is it even economical for a long-term solution? We're optimistic about it, but, you know, we need to prove that. And also need to evaluate disposal because if, it, you know, if you're pulling these nasty toxins out of the water, you've got to have an environmentally responsible disposal plan and not move the contamination from the water to a landfill or, you know, or an underground water source.
Exactly. And we have a call coming in from Pat in Fort Myers. Pat has a question. What would you like to ask?
Well, I guess it's really not so much a question as it is a statement. We moved here 3 years ago because my husband has issues with breathing and we from a cold state, so we moved down here. And I wish we'd never moved here because we are afraid of the air quality here now. We used to go downtown all the time. We love it downtown, Fort Myers. We're not going anymore. Someone has to be able to tell me that he's not going to have an asthma attack or some sort of a negative lung event. Someone has to let me know that in 20 years I'm not going to get Parkinson's from breathing the foul air down there delivered by toxins from the green algae. It's not just the water. It's the air quality. And I feel very unsafe here in Florida now.
Pat, thank you so much for your comment. I'm going to ask Jennifer. I mean, you're kind of nodding over there. You ended up almost in the hospital, right?
Yes. I mean, I had asthma years and years ago and had stopped taking steroids and inhalers when I moved to Florida because the air quality is generally better here than the state I had moved from. So I actually improved. My health improved. But
so you can relate to what Pat's dealing
with. I can
with.
Absolutely relate to it. And it's a huge to a person who does suffer from these problems as far as your quality of life and your recreational abilities and things of that nature. But I think the bottom line is to understand that these toxins can be aerosolized. They can go into the airway, and some people are going to be more sensitive than others. But that doesn't mean that it isn't affecting others that don't have immediate symptoms or immediate responses.
She was talking about long-term things like Parkinson's and stuff.
There are some toxins that have been now linked with nervous system disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So it is of great concern to public health and safety as well. I mean, we don't mean to scare people, but I do think people need to be aware. And that's why it's so important that we make these investments now to address this problem before it gets any worse. We have to take this. At this point, I think it's reached a critical crisis level. It's going to affect our economy, our environment, and our quality of life. And we cannot afford to wait any longer to make the investments needed to address it.
So where you're coming from is we have to clean up what we've already done and stop continuing to do it.
Exactly.
How hard is it going to be to get everybody on that page? Do you feel like we're right now at a critical moment where we might all be able to get on that page together?
I think that conceptually everybody understands, you know, and wants to achieve that. It's about what are the necessary steps that are needed and the necessary investments and projects that are needed to do that. That's where you start to get a divergence of opinion. So, you know, really our role, again, as a convener is to pull the different entities together in the region and work collaboratively on coming up with a consensus-driven consolidated set of priorities that then we can give to the state and federal leaders for them to be able to implement. If we're all, you know, giving different ideas or different solutions, it makes it very difficult for those who control the purse strings to know where to disperse those funds and what would be the most useful thing to support. So we do need to figure out how to be more unified in our messaging. And I think that's one of the things we'd like to do is have a community conversation on the water quality problems where we focus on what are the specific steps and actions that we need to take, that we need to support as a community. And some of those things involve, frankly, things in our own backyard. I mean, it's not always things outside of our control. There is ownership. Every single person who lives in Southwest Florida in some way or another is affecting the water quality of our waterways. So what we can each do is take personal responsibility in making a change in our own lives and our own practices, and then looking at how do we support politically those other things that are needed to address the bigger problems.
After the show, we should put together a little cheat sheet of all the little things that every individual homeowner can do. That would be kind of a great resource so people can at least maybe feel like they're contributing to a solution.
Absolutely.
Let's work on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the time that we have for this part of our show, but I want to thank my guest, Jennifer Hecker. She's the executive director of the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank Scott Smith. He's the founder and CEO of Aquaflex. Scott, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
When we return, we pivot to another new technology developed by Moat Marine Laboratory that uses ozone to destroy and remove the organism that causes red tide from the water. They've tested it in canals on Boca Grande. We'll talk with a senior scientist from Moat to learn more. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.